This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes.
Last night in his primetime news conference, President Obama chose a metaphor from science fiction to explain the science of healthcare.
There's a blue pill and a red pill, and the blue pill is half the price of the red pill.
You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Why not pay half price for the thing that's going to make you well?
After this, there is no turning back. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
President Obama takes on the healthcare matrix, and we're headed down the rabbit hole of truth here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 23rd. I am Farai Chidea here with Lynn Scher. We are filling in for John Hockenberry. Morning.
Good morning, Farai.
All right. This hour on The Takeaway, we are going deep on jobs and joblessness. We'll have a conversation with job hunters who are on the front lines, see what's really going on, explore when the jobs are coming back. Plus, we'll get a review of some new technology that might allow you to find good music, new and old. We promise the conversation will bring joy to your life, or at least joy to vision. Right now, we'll talk to Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. He was actually at the president's news conference last night. Todd, we just heard a mashup of the president and the movie The Matrix. Now, in that movie, the forces of change prevail, but let's bring it back to reality. How do things look for the president's plan?
Well, good morning, Farai. I think it's going to be a little bit of a longer movie than maybe we expect. Doesn't look like that August deadline is going to be hit, but the president is doing his best to give this one a happy ending. I'm sorry I'm extending the metaphor so far, but he's trying to bring the plot back down to the human level, explain to real people why health reform matters to them, and he's hoping to be the hero, I suppose.
All right, Todd, we've got more with you in a moment. Thanks. So first, we've got everything you need to know this morning, Lynn.
In the headlines, Farai, the president is packed for Ohio, ready to sell his healthcare agenda. He's touring the Cleveland Clinic, which the Obama administration cites as a healthcare role model. President Obama holds a town hall nearby after the tour. Healthcare issues dominated last night's news conference, but the president touched on other issues as well. He answered a question on the racially charged arrest of Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates, Jr. He also talked financial regulation. We'll have a conversation about all of this coming up.
Again, we will get the latest job numbers in a few minutes. Weekly unemployment figures are coming out. We'll bring them to you in context. And North Korea says no thanks to new talks on nukes. This comes at a regional summit in Thailand. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is there also. She says Pyongyang has, quote, no friends left, unquote, to shield it from further punishment.
A couple of car makers reporting profits this morning. Both Ford and South Korea's Hyundai are out with positive new earnings reports. Ford's report is something of an asterisk, however. It's a profit on paper because Ford made moves to cut debt. Without that, it lost money in the second quarter.
All right. Wall Street didn't move much yesterday. The Dow starts trading at 88.81, S&P at 954, NASDAQ at 1926. President Obama had his say last night. It is your turn. You know, did he answer the questions that you have? Let us know. 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
If we do not control these costs, we will not be able to control our deficit. If we do not reform health care, your premiums and out-of-pocket costs will continue to skyrocket. If we don't act, 14,000 Americans will continue to lose their health insurance every single day. These are the consequences of inaction.
President Obama last night at his primetime press conference, taking his case for health care directly to the public. Were you watching? Were you convinced? And will it be enough to win over a less than cooperative Congress? The Takeaway's Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick, was there at the White House, and he helps us analyze what happened. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Okay, did he get the votes?
Right. I can tell you definitely yes or definitely no. The president is trying to get votes. It's actually a good question. You know, the last few weeks, as I think a lot of people have noticed, this whole debate has gotten into the sphere of politics, some attacks, a lot of criticism over the cost of this plan. And it is going to be around $1 trillion. It's a lot of money, especially when you consider stimulus and TARP and budget and all of the other money that's been spent. So I think the president was really doing his best to try to bring the debate back down to the level of you and me, the regular person, middle class voter. What is this? He even said that. What does this mean to me?
Right,
you know,
exactly.
What dog do I have in this fight? He talked about people's premiums. He talked about their family budgets. He talked about their bottom line and their health care. And that's the power of the presidency. He gets to command a microphone for an hour in prime time and try to remind people why we're doing this, and also, frankly, remind people why the public overwhelmingly support Democrats when it comes to health care, and why overwhelmingly they support the president when it comes to health care. I think the White House thinks a lot of people have forgotten why they support the president on this, and they do. So he needs to remind them that they actually think that he's the guy on this.
Okay, Todd, and bringing his case directly to the people, as you say. The president also said in his press conference, this will not add to the deficit, and I mean it. And he also said this.
If I see a proposal that is primarily funded through taxing middle-class families, I'm going to be opposed to that.
Okay, Todd, so how's he going to pay for it?
Right. Well, the president actually made a little bit of news last night. You know, he was straddling two lines. One was this message we just talked about for the American people. The other was a message I think that was tailored for inside Washington and the debate that's going on right now, trying to influence it. The president made a little bit of news right there by saying that he would agree to this proposal to have sort of an independent commission that polices Medicare, a group of experts that polices Medicare and looks for places to cut costs and has the power to do it. Now, we had heard on the Hill that the White House was going to support that. He explicitly did, and that's going to satisfy a lot of those conservative blue dog Democrats who are concerned about cost.
Okay. Thanks, Todd. Stand by, please. Also watching the president last night was Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard and co-director of the Harvard Medical School General Internal Medical Fellowship Program. She is co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. Welcome, Dr. Woolhandler. And let me ask you, as a healthcare professional, what stood out to you the most from the president's remarks last night?
Well, most of what he said wasn't true. There's nothing in his plan that will actually control costs. His cost control measures are what some people have called faith-based cost control. They're things that the Congressional Budget Office has said will not save money. So he's not going to control cost. His plan will not fix private health insurance. Private health insurance is a defective consumer product that leaves people at risk for bankruptcy. Even if they have the private insurance throughout an illness, often people are bankrupted by gaps in coverage like co-payments, deductibles, and uncovered services. And while the president talked a lot about blocking insurance companies from canceling your policy, which is a step forward, it does not fix defective insurance, and insurance is still going to be full of gaps and still not going to keep the American people protected from bankruptcy in the event of serious illness.
Finally, let me interrupt you just a second, Doctor. Let me play a cut from one of the things the president talked about. He was talking about people getting bankrupted, as you're discussing.
This is about the woman in Colorado who paid $700 a month to her insurance company, only to find out that they wouldn't pay a dime for her cancer treatment, who had to use up her retirement funds to save her own life. This is about the middle-class college graduate from Maryland, whose health insurance expired when he changed jobs and woke up from the emergency surgery that he required with $10,000 worth of debt.
Now, you're saying, Dr. Steffi Woolhandler at Harvard, that that his numbers somehow don't add up. The examples he uses, are these not legitimate to talk about the problem?
Well, the examples are of people who had their insurance canceled in one case or had a really fraudulent insurance in the other. But the standard insurance product that most people have is an umbrella full of holes. That is, if you have a really serious illness, you'll still be bankrupted, even if you keep the standard private insurance policy. We know that because we just completed a study of 2,300 people in federal bankruptcy courts, which I think is the basis of the president's and many people's understanding of medical bankruptcy. And it turned out that most people who were bankrupted by illness had private health insurance. In fact, most of them had health insurance throughout the illness that bankrupted them. It wasn't a problem of a cancellation. It was a problem that they had the standard policy that many of us have, but it was full of co-payments, deductibles, uncovered services that left you bankrupted anyway, even if you kept the insurance. So he has not fixed the problem of medical bankruptcy with this, and he has not fixed the problem that private health insurance is a defective product.
So let me just ask, I hear you are very critical of what his program is. Was there any part of it last night that you do buy, or is there any part of it that you do support?
Well, the one thing he said I agreed with was he said if you want 100% coverage, you have to go to single payer. And that's true both because single payer automatically enrolls everyone, but also because single payer is the only affordable way to cover people, because with a single payer, you get rid of private insurance, you get rid of the administrative waste and overhead that having 1,500 different insurance companies brings into the system. You save about $400 billion annually on overhead and paperwork, and then you can use that money to cover everyone and improve the coverage of people who now have these defective private policies that are full of holes.
Okay, thanks, Dr. Will Handler. Well, healthcare was not the only headline last night. Turning now to David Wall Rice, assistant professor, of psychology at Morehouse College. We spoke to you, Mr. Rice, yesterday about the arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr., and last night the president was asked about that incident.
I think it's fair to say, number one, any of us would be pretty angry. Number two, that the Cambridge police acted stupidly in arresting somebody when there was already proof that they were in their own home.
But what did you really think, Mr. President? David Wall Rice, what is the relevance of this question being addressed by the president?
I think it's highly relevant. I think one thing that it does is it gives some credence to the issue of the possibility of racial profiling. I think, of course, the blow quote is that the Cambridge police acted stupidly, but I think that the president also explained that race still haunts us. I think that's something that's very important to outline. And one thing that he also said is that there was an indisputable fact that blacks and Hispanics are stopped by law enforcement disproportionately. So I think that one thing that he was able to do, and at the very end, what he was able to do was he was able to humanize the experience a little bit more. He was able to address it head on. And one thing that he allows is for there to be a sobering extension of the conversation. So I think it was very important for him to be able to talk about in that world stage.
Were you surprised that's essentially the second headline, and in some cases the first headline out of this news conference? The president did it, of course, to talk about health care. There were one or two other questions, almost nothing. The press corps sort of went along with his agenda except for that one question.
Yeah, I think I was pleasantly surprised. I'm not surprised it's a headline, obviously. And I think that, I think that, again, pleasantly surprised would be my reaction. I think that, again, he addressed the issue. I don't think it would be a question that wouldn't be asked of somebody if it weren't a black man. I mean, obviously, President Obama is a black man. I think that it gives it some more relevance because he's a black man, and it shows the possibilities that can extend in terms of racial reconciliation with him in the powerful seat that he sits in.
Just curious, do you think his comment that the Cambridge police, and I quote, acted stupidly, is going to come back to hit him in the face at any point?
I think it could, but if you look at the transcript and if you listen to it again, he said that they acted stupidly, and he separated that from a racial component.
Okay, thank you so much, David Wall Rice, back again, assistant professor of psychology at Morehouse College. I'm sure we'll be talking to you even more. And on healthcare, our own Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, who was at the news conference last night, as well as Dr. Steffi Wall Handler from Harvard University. Thanks to all of you for joining in.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, do you hear that song? If you like it, you can listen to it streaming, but not download it for free, legally. Joining us now to talk about why you don't have to fork out money to listen to music anymore is Maura Johnston, editor of the music blog Idolator. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
Great. Now, it's Thursday. We talk tech every Thursday, and we've gone from vinyl to tape to CDs, now streaming music that usually comes from your computer. So, you know, what's so good about streaming now compared to a few years ago?
Well, you know, a lot of the labels have sort of loosened their grip on allowing legal music and, you know, obviously, like, properly labeled music, that is, to stream from various services. You know, there are free services like iMeem and Lala and other, you know, pay services like Rhapsody, where you can just, you know, call up certain songs on your computer and listen to them. And depending on whether or not the labels have granted access to those songs, you can hear, like, high-quality versions, as opposed to the old days where if you were looking for a song online, you would get, you know, like, five things that were claiming to be, say, transmission by Joy Division, and, you know, four of them might be covers by other bands, or they might be really low quality.
Right.
So it's really sort of changed in terms of legality and that allowing for better quality songs to be accessible.
Yeah, I've played around with a little bit of making playlists on iMeme and Blip FM, which we'll talk about in a second. But there's a new service, or, you know, not even in the U.S. officially yet, called Spotify. What's special about it?
Well, Spotify people love because the interface is actually really elegant. It's very much like iTunes, and it's, you know, it's ad-supported, but it's ad-supported in such a way that it's very, like, minimally intrusive. And the catalog is just unparalleled. It's really, you know, it has a lot of songs. They just signed a deal where they added, like, 2 million songs from an independent distribution site, so that they have a lot of indie music now and other classical and stuff. And, you know, people just are raving about it. I mean, it's sort of the convenience of iTunes, but, you know, the sort of added convenience of not having to cost anything unless you want to skip all the advertisements entirely.
So, you know, who's making money off those ads? Is it the service, the labels, the artists? Who's making money?
It's usually, you know, the labels, and then they sort of are supposed to funnel the money to the artists, although that's something for the lawyers to figure out, I guess. But, you know, the services pay money to the labels in order to license the music. And unfortunately, you know, the problem is, like, the ad revenue right now is not really catching up with the fees that the labels, that the services are having to pay to the labels. So
yeah,
it's sort of, you know, everyone's in this dance of, like, trying to remain profitable while also continuing to provide the service.
Now, you know, we've talked a lot on the show about social networks, you know, places like Facebook. And I was on Blip FM, you know, one of the services, and the system gives you points for playing music that other people like, you know, usually more obscure cuts. And I actually played Institutionalized from Suicidal Tendencies.
Excellent song.
Yeah, you put me in an institution, said it was the only solution. I know you like that song, too. You know, I got points for that. And so how does social media play into this?
Well, I mean, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't, it doesn't. Like, I mean, with Blip FM, I know a lot of people enjoy sort of broadcasting on Twitter what they've been listening to, you know, but again, music is such a way for people to sort of connect that it becomes this sort of thing where you can bond with people and you can potentially maybe, you know, make new friends over the music that you're listening to. But I think what's most important to
the majority of people is just the ability to listen to the music and to sort of, you know, conjure up the memories brought up by listening to Institutionalized for the first time in however many years.
All right, Maura, again, Maura Johnston, editor of the music blog Idolator. Let's talk about what's not so legal. You can do something that is called ripping streams, and you can rip from radio and other places and kind of sneak around the barriers of legality. What goes on there?
Well, what happens, you know, is that you get a program when, like, say when an album is, like, streaming pre-release on a site and you want to own it for whatever reason, you can, you know, use a program to sort of basically do the equivalent of holding up a tape recorder to the computer, although it's all internally done. And then the problem with that is, you know, you get, like, a really bad quality. Like, the digital copying isn't perfect yet, so you get this sort of poorish quality. Like, whenever I hear an album that's been ripped from a stream, I can always sort of tell because it sounds like a little watery. So that's something that, you know, people will do if they feel like they really, really need an album right now. And it's been interesting, actually, because, you know, there were so many albums that leaked pre-release way before on majors that were coming out, you know, even a year ago. And now most of the leaks that I've seen have just been rips of these, you know, authorized streams. So the labels are really kind of doing a better job cracking down. And that's why you see this sort of people still using this technology to rip streams.
All right. Final word. A lot of people don't get that into tech. What's the one service people should try today?
Oh, geez. I like Lala. I think Lala's pretty good. I mean, if they want to deal with all the proxy server, they can muck around with Spotify, but, you know.
Okay. I think talking about proxy servers, we have entered nerd land. I'm going to leave it there. Maura Johnston, editor of the music blog Idolator, thanks. And now we turn to Femi with a little Joy Division and the headlines.
Thank you very much. I thought you were going to play that scary Institutionalized music again. 28 minutes past the hour. My teeth almost fell out. Good morning, everybody. President Obama criticized the local police who arrested Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates Jr. in his home earlier this week, saying that they acted stupidly. He spoke in a primetime news event last night, during which he also continued to pitch his healthcare reform. The president keeps campaigning on the healthcare overhaul today in Cleveland, Ohio. He will be visiting the Cleveland Clinic and then hold another town hall meeting. Meanwhile, Vice President Biden is doing his own traveling. Have a listen to the welcome he received when he arrived in the Republic of Georgia. Today, Vice President Biden holds talks with leaders in Georgia, and Georgia is expected to ask the U.S. for weapons. Heading up into space now, two astronauts had to cut their spacewalk short after one of their spacesuits had a problem. They headed back to the International Space Station, but another spacewalk is planned for tomorrow. Now, locals are rallying around the Idaho soldier captured in Afghanistan by the Taliban. Hundreds attended a rally for Private Bo Bergdahl in his hometown last night. Bergdahl went missing in June. Last weekend, he appeared in a video released by the Taliban. And that is a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So, last night, President Obama said new hirings will be the last to come back in this economy. Where does that leave the jobless now? That's the issue coming up next on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
We do expect to see positive job creation near the end of this year, early next year. But it's going to take a while, given the pace of growth, for the unemployment rate to come back down to levels that we would be more comfortable with.
Bad news, good news, bad news, a little bit of everything. That was Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke testifying before Congress yesterday. Last night, President Obama added, and I quote, "I'll be honest, new hirings are the last to come back," unquote. So, where does that leave the jobless today? Can they afford to wait? Joining us now is Roger Lowenstein, who writes in his article for this Sunday's New York Times Magazine that the lack of job hiring is more troubling than job losses. Also joining us is Fred Winner. He runs a welding company in Western Ohio, and he's had to let go many employees, while at the same time he's seen his work hours cut. Finally, we have Boreas Van Nieuwhuis, who lost his job last November as a carpenter in Kauai, in Hawaii. He is still looking for work. Welcome to all of you. And Roger Lowenstein, let me start with you. Why should we be more concerned with the lack of hiring than with the job loss rate?
Well, good morning. Because as brutal as the job losses have been, there are only so many people that can be fired or lose their jobs before everything shuts down. And eventually that process will stop. But over time, what regenerates the economy are new jobs. Over 10 to 15 years, a great portion of the jobs that we have are jobs that never used to exist. The person on the show before talking about synthesizing music and so on, all these new firms, these are the things that keep breathing life into the economy. And if for some reason we stop creating jobs, the next generation, even this one, get in trouble.
And this obviously is all what you cover, I know, in your article in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. But let me ask you this. There is a lag, is there not, in the economic downturn between what we see and then the effect on workers. It's going to get a lot worse, isn't it, before it gets better?
I don't have a crystal ball, but generally it gets less. It gets worse before, even when the economy turns around. That is to say, even when factories start producing things again, or when your welder has more work. In the beginning, they don't go out and hire someone to do the extra welding. They say, let's just have the welders we have on site now do a little more, because we're not certain yet if this upturn is going to last, and we don't want to commit, or maybe we can't get a loan yet to hire people. So in the beginning, people just work a little harder.
Indeed, and we actually have a welder who we'll be talking to in just a minute. But first, I do want to bring in our guests who know firsthand about this, and Farai has a very special relationship with one of them. Farai?
Yeah, I actually met Boreas Van Nieuwhuis. You're the brother of a friend of mine. I got to go to one of the most amazing, beautiful paradises in the world, which is where you live, Kauai, Hawaii. But, I was walking around, I saw these $12 million houses, and you're a carpenter, and what happened to the economy?
Well, things slowed down here a lot. It was booming for many years on Kauai with a lot of construction of high-end homes. Wealthy people would come here, build vacation homes, and that's what the kind of work I was doing. And all of a sudden, things started to fall through, and jobs that were lined up got put off or canceled, and people started getting laid off, and I got laid off, and there wasn't a lot of more stuff going on to go out and get another job. So it's been pretty slow here.
So Boreas, Lynn Scher here, you have Roger, by the way, points out in his piece that one out of six construction workers is out of work. You've had to look elsewhere, right?
Yeah, I mean, mostly I haven't been working too much, but I did get a temporary job with the Census Bureau for a while, and, that was something that kept me busy for a while and was good. But as far as construction, there's not too much. A lot of people in my position have been picking up smaller jobs just to try to keep busy. But as far as the steady work, there's a lot less.
Let me bring in Fred Winner now. He is, in fact, the man who runs a welding company in Western Ohio. Mr. Winner, have your hours been cut because of the recession?
Well, we're probably down to 35 tops per week.
From what, Mr. Winner?
Well, we used to work 40, 45, 50 last year, the year before.
And how many people have you had to lay off so far?
We laid about seven off. We're down to two of them. We're just trying to keep two of us busy.
Ben Bernanke from the Federal Reserve has an answer for that. Let's take a listen.
They find themselves with atrophying skills and inability to find work once the economy has recovered. And so I would call to your attention the possibility of expanding training and other programs that would help people maintain those skills or develop new skills.
Fred Winter, are you willing to retrain, or can your folks retrain?
Well, I suppose the younger ones could. I'm going to be 65 in a couple of days. I'm not too much worried about it. But I guess the younger ones will have to if the work's not there.
Doesn't sound good. Carpentry, welding, Roger Lowenstein, is this going to just keep getting worse and worse?
Well, what your other guests pointed out, that they're working less and working part-time, that's one of the things that makes it seem as though it will get worse and take a long time to recover, because if companies were on the verge of needing new workers, the workers they already had would be working full-time. But if people are working fewer hours, and actually in the last month survey, we're down to a record low since they've been keeping the data of 33 hours a week for the people who are working. Well, presumably then, you know, when there is a little more welding to do, when there is a little more construction work on those wealthy homes in Hawaii, which sound great, by the way, the people who already have jobs will work a few hours longer each week, and then we'll have to sort of run through them, get them back up to speed, the people who are still working, before we, you know, actually start looking for new hires and getting new people jobs.
Indeed, and I have a feeling we will be continuing this conversation. Roger Lowenstein from the New York Times. You can read his piece in this Sunday's magazine. Also with us was Fred Winter from Western Ohio and Boreas Van Nieuwhuis from Hawaii. And now for more on jobs and joblessness, Femi OK with the headlines. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Lynn. Thank you very much. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. As Lynn says, we've just got some fresh numbers out on the job market. The Labour Department has reported that in a twist from recent weeks, new claims for jobless benefits were up last week. More than expected, 554,000 people filed for benefits, but the total number of people on the benefit payroll has dropped. The president continued his push for healthcare reform last night in a primetime news conference. He said that he backs a tax on families making more than $1 million a year to help pay for the healthcare overhaul, but he will reject any legislation that funds it mostly through taxes on the middle class. And in California, legislatures will work through a stack of budget bills today in an attempt to vote on a balanced budget deal by tomorrow. That's a quick look at top stories making the news headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. And in this healthcare debate, there are a few models we can look to. So what are they doing right that the rest of the nation can do too? More on that coming up in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scher.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Vice President Biden is overseas visiting the former Soviet territory, now an independent nation, of Georgia today on a trip that's also included a stop in the Ukraine. The vice president said the U.S. will support Georgia's territorial integrity.
The reason I'm back and the reason President Obama asked me to come back was to send an unequivocal, clear, simple message to all who will listen and those who even don't want to listen, that America stands with you at this moment and will continue to stand with you.
Now, Georgia is expected to ask the U.S. for weapons. That's a sensitive subject as Georgia and Russia went to war nearly a year ago. Now, Russia is saying it'll take measures to prevent Georgia from rearming. To make sense of all of this, we have BBC Russian Affairs analyst and a friend of The Takeaway, Stephen Eek, who joins us from London. Now, Stephen, Biden said yesterday the U.S. would stand by Georgia. What happens if they go to war again?
Well, good morning. There was just a very clear and unequivocal statement from Mr. Biden that you've played out, in which he makes a very clear statement on U.S. policy. There have been lots of questions in recent weeks indeed since the Obama administration took shape over whether the restarting of relations with Russia would mean a change in that previous policy of very strong support for Georgia and for its government of President Mikhail Saakashvili. One of the questions that remains unanswered, of course, is does support for Georgia mean direct support personally for President Saakashvili, whose opponents say he has shown himself over recent months to be far from democratic? That remains to be seen. But as far as the issue of weapons is concerned, this is really the litmus test, I think, of the efforts to restart relations between the United States and Russia, because the Russians say there is no way they are going to tolerate the rearming of Mr. Saakashvili's government, which they see as provocative and a danger to the region. There's been a statement from the Russian Foreign Ministry just this morning that says that Russia believes that the Georgian government is moving towards rearmament and it will take measures against third countries assisting that process.
Well, just give us a tiny bit on the state of play between the U.S. and Russia. I mean, you heard Putin just giving some tough talk to the U.S. a while ago, changing roles in Russia, but still very influential. What's the state of play?
Well, we've seen President Obama's first visit to Moscow just a couple of weeks ago and the efforts to restart relations. But given the depths to which they'd actually plunged, and both sides actually say, look, we're almost at a level of the Cold War. This is like something from the 1970s being rerun. The problems are profound. They are fundamental in many respects, including how the countries bordering Russia, like Ukraine and Georgia, how they build their foreign alliances. Russia still perceives those countries to lie within a poorly defined sphere of its own influence, and it resents what it sees as foreign interference, particularly from the United States. The idea that Ukraine or Georgia should form pro-Western alliances isn't something that goes down very well in Moscow, whereas Washington sees it very much as these countries' own prerogative, these countries' own right to set their own foreign policies without, as it sees it, interference from Washington. It remains to be seen how this issue will actually play out in the recent months, but it's a real one and it causes a lot of concern in Moscow.
All right. Well, BBC Russian Affairs Analyst, friend of The Takeaway, Stephen Eek, thank you so much.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Lynn Scher here with Farai Chidea. We're in for John Hockenberry. There are a couple of models for healthcare that we can look to in this debate. We're going to find out what we can learn from them in just a minute, right after headlines with Femi Okeh. Morning, Femi.
Good morning, everybody. 12 minutes to the top of the hour almost. And healthcare was a hot topic at the president's news conference last night. President Obama also got a question on the arrest of the Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates Jr. Cambridge police suspected a crime when the black professor forced the door open to his home. Now, the president said he didn't have all of the facts about what role race played, but says that police acted stupidly. He says he understands how skin color can affect policing.
I mean, if I was trying to jigger in, well, I guess this is my house now, so it probably wouldn't happen. But let's say my old house in Chicago. Here I'd get shot.
Well, police have dropped the charges against Gates. Friends, family and well-wishers are expressing support for the Idaho soldier captured in Afghanistan by the Taliban. Hundreds rallied in Private Bo Bergdahl's hometown last night. He's been missing since June. He showed up last weekend in a Taliban video. A couple of car makers are reporting profits this morning. Both Ford and South Korea's Hyundai are out with some positive new earnings reports. In Ford's case, though, it's a paper profit only because Ford has been working to reduce its debt. So technically, Ford really lost money in the second quarter. I hope I haven't lost you there. Hyundai says that second quarter profit jumped almost 50% from last year. The South Korean company is the world's fifth largest automaker, along with its affiliate Kia. And finally, the feds want you to help fight H1N1 or swine flu. Government researchers need volunteers to test a new vaccine. Now, time is pretty short. They want to give shots to the general public before the fall flu season, but they can't give it out until it's judged to be safe. The National Institutes of Health wants adult volunteers first of all. It also wants to test the shots on babies if the adult trials go well. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. The president's televised campaign for his health care bill last night wasn't all about wishful thinking. He cited at least one real example of a model system, one that is on his itinerary today.
I'm going to be visiting your hometown tomorrow to go to the Cleveland Clinic to show why their system works so well. And part of the reason it works well is because they've set up a system where patient care is the number one concern, not bureaucracy, what forms have to be filled out, what do we get reimbursed for. Those are changes that I think the American people want to see.
Well, the Cleveland Clinic isn't the only one on Mr. Obama's to-do list. The various bills in his very complex plan have also looked at the innovative work being done at places like the Mayo Clinic and the Geisinger Health System in Pennsylvania. Those facilities all have reputations for providing cheaper, better health care. We wanted to check in with one of those clinics, and we have with us one of the people who makes Geisinger run. Megan King is a perinatal nurse at Geisinger in Danville, Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Good morning.
Megan, the theory is that better patient care reduces costs. How do you provide better care to your patients?
Well, patient care has changed a lot over the last couple of years, but innovatively, Geisinger went through reforming the way we do patient care by putting together something we call proven care, and that's the way that we can standardize our care, making sure every patient, no matter what clinic they go to, for example, we have 22 OB clinics, so whether they go to the Mount Pocono site or the Geisinger-Danville site, they will get the same care with the same education, the same testing everywhere they go. And so through that, we're able to make sure that every patient has the same high standard of care, and we'll be able to make sure that we're on the lookout for things that may cause preterm labor, early deliveries, infections, and those kinds of things. So working smarter is good patient care.
So how is that different from what a patient might get at another clinic in another place?
Well, because we've put the standards together, every single physician, every single nurse is responsible for all the levels of care. What we did is we found that even though we were providing excellent care in all of our clinics, we weren't doing it all at the same time at the same part of the prenatal care. And so sometimes things would not come across the same way. The education wasn't done at the same standard, so it makes it across the board better. And it's done so well that the March of Dimes has come along and said that they think that we've done such a good job, they'd like to see it become part of their standard of care for avoiding preterm babies.
Megan King speaking to us from Danville, Pennsylvania. Stand by if you would, Megan. Let me turn now to Mark Allen. He studies the healthcare system and directs the Health Sector Management Program at the Boston University School of Management. He joins us now from our partner, WGBH in Boston. Welcome, Mark Allen. What are these places doing right that the rest of the healthcare system is missing?
Well, places like Cleveland Clinic are, the president's absolutely correct, organizing care around the patient and their condition and needs. And it may seem an obvious approach, but traditionally our academic medical centers are organized around physician specialties. The cardiologists in medicine have their world, the surgeons and cardiac surgeons have theirs, the radiologists and so on. And care is provided in a fragmented way. People are concerned about the patient, but it's not as effective and certainly not as efficient as it might be. Places like Cleveland Clinic have reorganized around teams of specialists who are focused on the particular needs of patients.
Well,
they've also.
Pardon me for interrupting. You're talking about Cleveland, and obviously, would you put Geisinger in that category as well, where Megan King is over in Pennsylvania?
Geisinger, Mayo, Cleveland are all they are variations on a theme of focusing on that patient need.
And can these programs be scaled up so that they can work on a national level?
Well, you're talking about a system change, and what's critical now is we have a system where the incentives are to pay for activities. The more activities, the more procedures you carry out, the more revenue you receive. We need to change to a system that pays for patient outcomes, for patients improving, for success of care. That will create an incentive for other organizations to operate more like Cleveland Clinic, Geisinger, or Mayo.
As the cost of healthcare goes down, if it ever does go down, if any of these programs get adopted, doesn't that mean that the healthcare systems will be earning less money?
Yes, that's a critical point I think people often don't realize. Everyone speaks in favor of lowering cost, but every cost in the system is actually revenue, money in the pocket for some part of the system, which they feel is essential to meeting their needs. So when people talk about cost savings, they tend to be thinking about others. This creates resistance to change within the system, and that's part of what the people in Washington are struggling with today.
Megan King, let me go back to you at the Geisinger Clinic in Danville, Pennsylvania. If costs go down, as I just said, if profits go down at Geisinger, how does that affect your care?
I don't know. You know, I'm a clinician, so I'm where the rubber meets the road, so I expect that I will be a nurse, and I will provide good nursing care regardless of policies or what comes down the pike, because that is the standard of Geisinger. We are expected to provide excellent patient care. It is our standard, always has been. So by working smarter, working better, giving patients good care, I'm not sure that I'll see a change at the patient level other than doing a really good job.
Mark Allen at the Boston University School of Management. What about that? Are patients going to feel the difference?
Well, a place like Geisinger or Mayo will benefit from that change in payment incentive because they're already producing outcomes efficiently, so that they will see the continued positive care. We're looking at the rest of the system beginning to emulate Cleveland Clinic or Geisinger more closely in the future.
And, of course, the big question is whether those models can indeed be scaled up so they can be adopted at a national level. President Obama today at Cleveland Clinic. I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more about that. Mark Allen from Boston University School of Management, thanks for joining us from the studios of our partner WGBH. And Megan King at the Geisinger Health System in Danville, Pennsylvania. Thanks to both of you.
All right. President Obama had his say last night. It is your turn. Did you hear what you wanted from the president? Were you convinced on health care, or do you still have questions or concerns?
Troy calling from North Dakota. For me, Obama still didn't answer how we're going to pay for all this, and I think we should stop being the worldwide war machine. We should close every foreign base, bring all our soldiers home, and that could pay for the health care overhaul.
Tom from Easton, Massachusetts also emails, a new email. We can afford to do this. The government already does a health care system for the VA and the Congress, so why not for us? The time has come. Tell us what your takeaway was from Obama, 877-8-MY-TAKE by phone, or email mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's a takeaway from this hour.
The standard insurance product that most people have is an umbrella full of holes. That is, if you have a really serious illness, you'll still be bankrupted, even if you keep the standard private insurance policy.
That's Dr. Steffi Woolhandler from Harvard University, co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program.
I'm Lynn Scher.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
President Obama took to the primetime podium last night with one big job, salesman for a national health care plan.
You know, I would be happy to abide by the same benefit package. I will just be honest with you. I'm the President of the United States, so I've got a doctor following me every minute. Which is why I say this is not about me. I've got the best health care in the world. I'm trying to make sure that everybody has good health care, and they don't right now.
The White House doctor is following him every minute, and so are we this morning on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It is Thursday, July 23rd. I'm Lynn Scher here with Farai Chidea, and we're filling in today for John Hockenberry. Morning, Farai.
Hey, Lynn.
On The Takeaway this hour, the government wants you to roll up your sleeve and play guinea pig for an H1N1 or swine flu vaccine test. We'll talk to the leading scientist on a medical trial with a hard deadline. Flu season is around the corner. Right now, let's talk healthcare broadly. T.R. Reid is author of The Healing of America. You have visited and been treated by healthcare systems all over the world. Do you think the president sold his healthcare plan last night?
Boy, he's a good salesman, but, you know, he's going at it differently from other countries. All the other countries decided first, we're going to cover everybody, and then designed a system to do it. But he's got a problem because he's working with this complicated, expensive American system, and he's messing around with pieces of that system, which has never covered everybody.
T.R. Reid, thanks so much. More to come in just a moment. First, everything the rest of you need to know this morning. Farai?
Well, in the headlines, the latest weekly job numbers are just out this morning. 554,000 Americans filed new unemployment claims last week. That's a jump, and it's worse than forecasters expected. We had a conversation with some job seekers behind those numbers in an earlier hour. You can always go online at thetakeaway.org. President Obama's health care sales job starts in Ohio. He is touring the Cleveland Clinic this afternoon. The Obama administration cites that as a role model, and President Obama holds a health care town hall after that. We're going to take you to Ohio for a local reaction shortly.
Healthcare issues dominated last night's news conference, but the president touched on other issues as well. He answered a question on the racially charged arrest of Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates Jr. He also talked about financial regulation. A couple of car makers are reporting profits this morning. Both Ford and South Korea's Hyundai are out with positive new earnings reports. Ford's report is something of an asterisk, though. It's a profit on paper because Ford made accounting moves to reduce debt. Without that, it lost money in the second quarter. We'll break this all down for you coming up.
Friends, family, and ordinary people expressing support for the Idaho soldier, Private Bo Bergdahl, captured in Afghanistan. He's been missing since June.
And North Korea says no thanks to new talks on nukes. This comes at a regional summit in Thailand. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's there, too. She says Pyongyang has no friends left.
All right. President Obama had his say last night. It is your turn. Did you hear what you wanted from the president? Were you convinced on health care? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm rushed because I get letters every day from families that are being clobbered by health care costs. And they ask me, can you help? So I've got a middle-aged couple that will write me, and they say, our daughter just found out she's got leukemia, and if I don't do something soon, we just either are going to go bankrupt or we're not going to be able to provide our daughter with the care that she needs. And in a country like ours, that's not right.
Last night, in his fifth press conference since he's taken office, President Obama pitched his plan to overhaul the nation's healthcare system. For a performance review, we are joined by T.R. Reid, a veteran reporter, author of the forthcoming book, The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. Welcome to the program again. Tell me what surprised you last night about what the president had to say.
He's so articulate. He's a terrific salesman, but I still didn't come away with the notion that he's got a handle on getting everybody covered. And I think that's an interesting distinction. If you look at the problems with American healthcare, they are cost, coverage, and quality. So which one do you deal with first? What I found is all the other countries decided the first goal was to get everybody covered. Now, that's expensive, but if everybody's in the system, then you have the political will to make tough decisions on controlling costs. And it looks to me like Washington is going at it differently. They're worried, very worried about costs, and then later maybe they'll get everybody covered. I think they're aiming for 2013 or something. It's just not the way any other country did it.
And you are in a position to know that because your new book is about, what, you had an old shoulder injury. You went around seeing how it was dealt with in various countries?
Yeah, I went to the doctor in 10 countries to find out how they treat you, how long you have to wait, what the facilities are like, who pays for it, how much it costs. And the reason I did it is all the other industrialized democracies cover everybody with high-quality care, and they spend half as much as we do. How do they do that? And I think I figured out how they do it, but the more important question turns out to be, why do they do it?
Why can't we do it is the question.
Because we've never made the commitment, the richest country in the world, we've never made the commitment that everybody who needs medical care should get it. And one result is, according to the government, 20,000 Americans die every year of treatable diseases because they can't afford a doctor.
But that
doesn't happen in any other country.
Last night, President Obama made it very clear, as he has all along, he wants to see everybody covered.
But he's got a plan that is focused mostly on costs and mechanisms. The other countries have decided you got to have everybody in the game, and then you can make really hard decisions. As it is now, guess what? Everybody loves cost control until you try to cut costs at the local hospital, and then the local congressman goes in and says, oh, no, you can't cut my hospital. That's the problem.
What would you have asked the president had you been in that room last night?
I would ask him, what's the most important goal of a healthcare system? Is it to care for the health of the people or to protect the profits of the insurance companies and the hospital companies that are involved in the system?
And what do you think his answer would have been?
Well, he always said during the campaign that the goal of healthcare was to provide healthcare for every American. But the negotiations in Washington have largely turned on which industry is going to win and which industry is going to lose. And to me, that's kind of a distraction from the real goal.
How do you think it is going in terms of the ability of this administration to sell this plan to the public? This is a very different approach from the one that we used during the Clinton administration with their Harry and Louise ads on television.
Oh, I think the Harry and Louise approach is going to come back. That is, the people who are doing well in the current system are going to try to scare everybody and say, oh, gosh, it's going to be worse. It's going to be too expensive. You're going to lose out. And I think he spent the whole press conference last night trying to counter that. Actually, you'll be better off. You won't lose anything, and we'll spend less money. I don't know that he's made that case yet to the American people, but that's clearly the case. And, you know, you look at other countries, it's true. They cover everybody and spend half as much as we do.
Did the president win over the American people last night, do you think? Did he win over anybody in Congress?
Well, if he wins over the American people, in theory, he's going to win over Congress. That's how democracy works, we hope. The problem is people are scared now that this is going to be really expensive and they're going to lose something they've got now. And he spent the whole hour trying to counter that notion. So, and he's such an effective, articulate speaker. I think, yeah, he probably did win some people.
That, of course, is indeed what he's pushing for now, is to get it down to the individual and say, this is what's in it for you, correct?
Yeah, and I think I personally would like to hear more about the whole society. Even people who think they have good insurance probably don't want to live in a country that lets 20,000 of our neighbors die every year because they can't see a doctor. I would have liked to hear him more talk about the moral issue about being the only country that doesn't provide care for everybody, but you're right. He's focused on people who are worried about what they're going to lose.
I wouldn't be surprised if the moral issue doesn't come up in another press conference, however. T.R. Reid, veteran reporter, author of the new book, The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. Thanks so much.
Delighted to be here.
All right, Lynn, the president is rolling on to Shaker Heights, Ohio, suburb of Cleveland, and the Cleveland Clinic is his first stop on the trip. You could call it a checkup. The president is going to cap off the afternoon, though, with a town hall meeting, and local folks are ready for him. This is Shaker Heights resident Leon Johnson.
I'm not on health care, and I haven't been on health care in a while. It'd be very nice to have that, you know, to walk into a hospital and get health care for the problems that I might have. It's a real big issue for some people, and it's a real big issue for me.
We've got reporter Dan Bobkoff from WCPN Public Radio. He's going to join the people packing the Shaker Heights High School gymnasium this afternoon to hear the president. He's on the line now from Cleveland. Dan, why do you think the president picked Shaker Heights to visit?
Well, Shaker Heights is a really interesting place because it is very diverse racially and economically, but it's not very diverse politically. So it's sort of a very receptive place for the president. I think as much as 80% of the town voted for him, but it also makes a very nice backdrop for a campaign stop, if you will.
All right. What's on the president's agenda?
Well, I guess he lands around lunchtime and he's, You mentioned he's going to the Cleveland Clinic, which is often a very frequent stop for presidents who want to talk about health change because it is seen as the model for how to do it. They are very efficient. They do care for less money, and they don't provide any incentives to do unnecessary tests and procedures. So there is a private meeting there, and then I'm sure we'll hear a lot about it at the afternoon town hall meeting in Shaker Heights at the high school there.
Now, you know, last night the president referenced another clinic, the Mayo Clinic, and he kind of fended off a question about why Mayo had concerns about the health care plan. He said last night that many Americans look at the health care debate and ask, what's in it for me? So, you know, judging from Shaker Heights residents, people you've been talking to, has the president made his case?
Well, he is trying. You know, we talked to about 11 people, and every one of them knew the president was coming. Everyone knew it was about health care, and that's kind of rare when you go out trying to get the voice of the people. And so I really would say people are focused on this issue. I'm not sure if he's fully made the case yet that there is something in it for the people who are insured.
Now, we have a little bit of a statement from another Shaker Heights resident, Andrea Clark Holtz.
He's just an interesting person. I mean, I feel like he's our president. I feel like he's a friend of mine, even though I don't know him. So I just want to encounter him.
Now, what kind of heat, if any, do you think the president will take from residents of Shaker Heights, and not just on, you know, health care, but maybe on the economy?
Well, you know, I can tell you that there are going to be a bunch of protests outside the high school there. So, you know, we are expecting somewhat of a bit of a, you know, an exchange. And the crowd was chosen by lottery, so he doesn't really know what he's getting when he walks in there. You know, the economy is a huge issue here in Cleveland. We were for a while sort of the foreclosure capital of the world. We have very high unemployment here in Ohio, above 10%. So, you know, healthcare is obviously a part of that, but there are a lot of issues there, and people are tired of the bad economy.
Do you have any sense of how your state is doing with providing and paying for health care? You know, some places like Massachusetts have really been strapped.
Well, you know, our budget is as bad as every other state's right now. We have massive cuts. We had a big stalemate trying to get a budget. So, you know, everything here is strapped, and that includes health care. And I'm sure we could use a little help from the federal government if they get their act together in Washington.
I remember the huge crowds during the campaign for the presidency when Obama was at another high school. It was just totally packed in South Carolina. Do you think some people are going to be disappointed if they don't get in just quickly?
I know a lot of people tried to get in. A lot of people didn't get tickets. I think, you know, it's just a school gymnasium. It probably holds, what, 2,000 or 3,000 people. It's a very big county here, over 1 million people. And I know you know, when it's not campaign season, a lot of people don't expect the president to come to Ohio. And I talked to a lot of people last night who were trying to get in.
Right.
A lot of disappointed people out there.
Okay, well, you're in the pole position. Dan Bobkoff, WCPN Public Radio reporter. Thanks.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Calling all guinea pigs. The U.S. government is seeking volunteers, thousands of volunteers, from babies to the elderly, to roll up their sleeves for the first clinical trials of H1N1 flu vaccine. That's the one we used to call swine flu, to determine whether a new vaccine really will protect against this virus before its expected rebound in the fall. The tests start in August, and if successful, you may be able, to get a vaccine as early as mid-October. But will the vaccines work? Will there be enough for everyone? Here to tell us is Dr. Anthony Fauci. He is director of the organization that will oversee the trials, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci, of course, has done pioneering research on other epidemics, mostly AIDS. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Dr. Fauci, give us the basics. How's this trial going to work?
Well, we're going to ask a couple of fundamental questions. The vaccine is already being produced in anticipation of the decision of whether or not to use it, as you mentioned, in mid-October. But before you do that, you need to ask a question. First of all, is it safe, at least in the short run, because you'll be able to observe it for a couple of months. But importantly also, does it induce an immune response or a response in the body that you would predict would be protective, and what is the correct dosage and number of doses to give to individuals? We need to get that information if we're going to have a good and efficient and effective vaccine program when the time comes.
Is this sort of trial always done when you have a new vaccine?
When you have a vaccine that's really new, we do this. This vaccine is extremely similar to the seasonal vaccines that we give routinely each year. Every fall and winter, we have the seasonal flu vaccine that's made available. It's made by the same companies, the same process, et cetera. The only thing that's different is that this is a different strain, a new strain that obviously people in the United States, particularly in New York City and New York State and throughout the world, had experience with, unfortunately, this spring with a considerable number of cases. So that's the newness of it. But the process of making it and all of the things that we go through are really strikingly similar to what we do every year with the standard seasonal flu vaccine.
Is there any danger to the people who are going to roll up their sleeves for this one?
You know, whenever you get into a clinical trial, whenever you have a vaccine and you put it into someone who's normal, there's always a very, very small risk. For the most part, and historically and consistently, the situations, namely the risk of the disease, is clearly much, much greater than the risk of the vaccine. You never can say that there's not a risk. I mean, that would not be honest. There's always a risk. We think the risk is extremely small because we give tens of millions of doses of seasonal flu vaccine each year to adults, the elderly, children, and there's not a significant at all a degree of adverse effects.
And a danger even as small for children as young as 6 months?
Again, we have experience throughout many, many years of giving the seasonal flu vaccine to children 6 months of age and over. You always have to say honestly that whenever you have a clinical trial on something that's new, there is always a finite risk, usually a minuscule small risk, but nonetheless, it's not no risk.
Well, Dr. Fauci, from what I understand, the flu virus mutates really quickly. And also, correct me if I'm wrong, this one can travel from pig to bird to human. You know, is it possible to really stay up with all those changes?
Well, I have to correct you. I'm really sorry.
Please do. I asked you to.
We don't know how this virus jumped from probably a pig to a human. We just don't know. It has genes of a bird virus, of a human virus, and a pig virus. It has been circulating in pigs for about a decade. But what the event was that made it get to humans, we don't know. But I can address real briefly, I think what the question you're saying is this going to change so much that the vaccine is not going to work.
Exactly.
Is that the point you're getting to? Well, if that's the point, you never can guarantee that that won't happen. However, there are some things that are going on to make us believe that it is unlikely that that would happen. And what's happening is that if you examine the molecular genetic makeup of the virus that first appeared to our knowledge in early April and compare it to the virus that's now been circulating several months, not only here in the United States but throughout the world, it's virtually unchanged, essentially identical to what it was, which is telling us that it is certainly not changing in a significant way. You never can predict because viruses are unpredictable, but it doesn't look like it's swaying or drifting or shifting at all.
Which is so far good news.
For
I sitting there with our pigs and birds and trying to get it all. We're all trying to get it all.
Yeah,
I
love the fact that it has all these genes anyway.
Dr. Fauci, this we've been hearing all along that this is the big one that we're all really worried about, that whatever the H1N1 was that was circulating, that was getting kids out of school and laying us all up for a little while with bad colds and sore throats, the thing you've really been worried about was this mutation. Is this, in fact, going to be as bad as everyone anticipates?
Well, it will likely, again, but with no guarantees, it will likely be quite similar to what we saw in the spring, which means in the broad big picture, it would be characterized as a mild to, at the worst, moderate flu season. So it is not acting like an overwhelmingly, as we say, virulent virus. However, the one disturbing issue about it is that when you look not only what you saw in New York City, but also in other states and Mexico and what they're seeing in Argentina now, is that it seems to have a predisposition to younger people. And there are an unusual number of cases, not a lot, but enough to make us keep our eye on it, of young, otherwise healthy young people who get very sick and rarely die. In general, with a regular flu season, most of the deaths, I think people don't appreciate it, there are 36,000 deaths each year, every year in a seasonal flu. Most of those cases are in elderly individuals and people with underlying conditions that compromise their ability to respond. Pregnant women are at increased risk, and very, very young children are at risk of serious complications.
Thank you, Dr. Anthony Fauci, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And now we go to Femi with the headlines.
Thanks, Lynn. 29 minutes past the hour. Fresh numbers out this morning on the job market. So in a twist from recent weeks, new claims for jobless benefits were up last week more than expected. 554,000 people filed for the benefit, but the total number of people on the benefit payroll has actually dropped. Today, the president heads to Cleveland, Ohio, to keep campaigning on healthcare reform. He will be visiting the Cleveland Clinic, which he calls a role model for the type of change Americans want. And finally, Vice President Biden is also traveling. Have a listen to the welcome he received when he arrived in the Republic of Georgia. The VP will be holding talks with leaders in Georgia, and Georgia is expected to ask the U.S. for weapons. And that is a quick look at your headlines.
All right. Thank you so much, Femi. And we are going to talk more about healthcare.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
At the trading fair.
At the trading fair.
At your Ford dealer's trading fair. All the 60 Fords are going to be there. At your Ford dealer's trading fair.
Wow, that is a great old ad. It's got new relevance, though. More people might be shopping at their Ford dealer fair because the automaker is posting a surprise second quarter profit. It's one of several developing auto stories here and abroad, but we'll start here now. Ford is the only one of the big three automakers not to have undergone a recent bankruptcy, and it reaped a profit of $2.8 billion for the second quarter. On the face of it, it's a good news story, but is that the whole picture? Joining us is Nick Bunkley. He writes about the auto industry for our partner, the New York Times, and he's interrupting the Ford conference call to join us this morning. Thanks for that. And Nick, you know, what are Ford's profits, you know, telling us about the health of the company?
Well, really, as much as it's possible for a American automaker in the midst of this horrible slump in the industry to be on a roll, Ford seems to be sort of doing just that right now. They reported it's actually a $2.3 billion profit, but that does include quite a bit that they gained from some debt restructuring. So they did lose a little bit of money in the quarter on their actual operations. But it still it was far better than some analysts had been expecting, and of course much better than its competitors have been doing lately.
Well, again, with the competitors, you know, what's Ford doing right?
Well, part of it is just that they didn't go through bankruptcy and they didn't take any bailout money from the government, and that's really drawn some positive attention to them. And of course, this all goes back to something they did a couple of years ago, even before any of this downturn started, when they basically mortgaged the whole company and borrowed a bunch of money that has been sustaining them through this period. So that's every day turning out to be just a better decision that they made, really not knowing how much it was going to help them.
Okay, Nick Bunkley, stay with us. You're from the New York Times auto industry writer, and now we have the BBC's business correspondent, Russell Padmore, who joins us from London. Russell, I understand you're excited about the luxury car maker Porsche, which had an abrupt change in leadership. What's their story?
We've been watching in recent days, actually, different developments connected to the auto industry. Intriguing today here in Europe, a long-running battle between Volkswagen and Porsche seems to have come to an end with Volkswagen the winner. To give you a bit of history about it, let's go back in time. What's happened today first, Wendelin Wiedeking, he's the boss of Porsche. We now know he's going to step down. He's been at the company 16 years. Now, a long time ago, he started engineering a situation that, because Volkswagen looked like it was having financial difficulties, he thought it might be nice for the smaller sports car maker to buy its big rival. And they continued to build up shares in Volkswagen with the idea eventually that Porsche would have control. But the trouble was, Porsche got into debt buying those shares. It's accumulated debts of about $14 billion. And now Volkswagen's turned around and decided that because Porsche's in debt, it will buy control of Porsche. There's been a bit of a battle between Wendelin Wiedeking and the chairman of Volkswagen, Ferdinand Piëch. I will get to the family element in a moment, but effectively Wendelin Wiedeking is out. Volkswagen gets its way. Ferdinand Piëch, who effectively runs Volkswagen, but his family are also shareholders in Porsche, is going to get his way. And in this David versus Goliath battle, I'm afraid in this case, the German Goliath of Volkswagen becomes the winner.
All right. Well, that sounds like a bit of a soap opera. I want to get you and Nick to give a very quick take on the South Korean auto company Hyundai. And it's the fifth largest automaker. Russell, just give us a little tiny bit on how they did.
We had some confident news from Hyundai today. This company seemingly doing well, and because many other companies, GM, for example, have been lagging behind, restructuring and that sort of thing, slowly but surely this South Korean company's managed to build itself up into one of the bigger players in the world. Good news from an Asian car manufacturer, and of course, I suppose a lot of it is being driven by demand in Asia. We're watching Ford, we talked about them a few moments ago, trying to develop their market in Europe. GM having troubles in Europe and doing its best to sell off the likes of the Opel brand. It's intriguing, though, that probably because some of those economies in Asia, particularly China, are doing well, that's helped Hyundai.
Well, Russell, thank you for that insight, BBC's business correspondent. And we're going to go back to Nick Bunkley of the New York Times. Is there anything that Ford can learn, or all the American automakers can learn, from Hyundai?
Well, certainly Hyundai has been doing very well in the United States as well. They've been doing some leading-edge types of programs to get attention to themselves. Starting earlier this year, Hyundai had the program that allowed people to buy a vehicle, and if they lost their job, they would be able to take care of some payments and not have their credit rating take a big hit. And that's something that, both GM and Ford followed on a little bit earlier this summer. And then Hyundai is also trying to jump ahead with this Cash for Clunkers program here in the United States that's about to start starting basically tomorrow. But all this month, Hyundai's been allowing its dealers to give buyers a credit through that program. So that's also gotten some of the automakers here in the U.S. looking at ways they can better take advantage of that. So they've really done very well in drawing attention to themselves, and Ford has done that as well, which has really helped them this year.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Nick Bunkley, who writes about the auto industry for our partner, the New York Times. And we also had earlier the BBC's business correspondent, Russell Padmore from London. Now we turn to Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. President Obama criticized the local police who arrested the Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates Jr. in his home earlier this week, saying that they acted stupidly. In fact, he was arrested actually last Thursday. Now, Gates spoke in a primetime news event last night where he also continued to pitch his healthcare reform. The president keeps campaigning on the healthcare overhaul today in Cleveland, Ohio. In Idaho, more than 500 people attended a vigil last night in the hometown of the Idaho soldier who was captured in Afghanistan by the Taliban. President Obama has said that the military is doing everything it can to rescue him. Now, we're just getting some news out from our partner, the New York Times. Now, the New York Times company posted soaring profits last quarter. The Times company says that profits were up almost 85% from the same time last year, even as ad revenue plunged, and that's thanks to some major cuts in their operating costs. And international news, Iceland wants to be in the European Union. It has just put in a formal application today. Iceland has long prized independence from Europe, but support for EU membership grew after the country's recent economic troubles. That's a look at some stories making headlines this morning.
Thanks, Femi. The arrest of Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. is still sparking questions. Coming up, we'll talk about one issue. What are cops taught when it comes to race and racial profiling? That's coming up in 10 minutes here on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm Lynn Scherr. North Korea's official media has described the U.S. Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, as an unintelligent, funny lady. It's also restated that the six-party talks, which North Korea left in anger last year, were dead. Mrs. Clinton is attending a regional summit in Thailand. She'd earlier urged the communist country to renounce nuclear weapons irreversibly. For more on this, I spoke earlier with BBC correspondent Jill McGivering. I first asked her to give us insights into what's going on between Secretary Clinton and the North Koreans.
It is not good in terms of the mood, and it's not good in terms of the rhetoric. I think there's a sense at the moment that we've seen tensions gradually escalate. There is concern in the North Korea about what it means to have had a change of administration in the US. And I think generally what we're seeing now is a North Korea that is in flux, that is backed against the wall and is angry and is lashing out. But the real concern is how serious are they when they say things like this whole six-party talks mechanism that's been the focus of trying to deal with North Korea for the last 6 years. When they say that's dead, do they really mean it? And if so, what on earth comes next? Or is it just another bluff, which is the kind of thing that we have seen from in the past?
And if, in fact, the six-party talks are over, that means effectively there is no chance for any kind of agreement on anything, including nukes, right?
It's just very hard to see how you engage with North Korea. This has been the problem. In the last 6 years, everything has been focused on this idea of the six-party talks. And the concept was, look, it's really difficult for the West to deal consistently with North Korea, to get any kind of agreement to stick, and to make sure there's proper leverage. So maybe if we have China hosting the talks and also Russia, an ally of North Korea, if they're around the table as well, maybe the North Korea will be less suspicious, maybe we'll have more leverage.
Jill McGivering from the BBC, you've been covering Asia for quite a long time. Talk to me about Mrs. Clinton. Were her remarks, do you think, inappropriate? Or does this seem to be something that was planned in advance, or is there something emotional going on here?
I think it's very clear that the administration decided to send Mrs. Clinton to this particular big regional meeting, partly as a sign of saying, look, Asia is a big priority for us, we're engaging with it, it matters to us, we're sending our Secretary of State. But also, I think, to cover a couple of areas that are of great concern. One of them, North Korea. How on earth do we deal with it? We want some support from Asian allies. We have to, you know, really bang the table and say we are serious about this. And the other one is Burma, where a similar message, long-term problems, human rights and so on, we're getting nowhere, we need the region's help. So I think part of it is that she's gone with a tough message and a kind of rhetorical big stick to say, make it clear to other Asian allies, we have to do something about this. The status quo cannot continue. And I think that's part of the sort of rhetoric she's chosen.
Is this a wise decision, do you think? Is this the way to deal with North Koreans?
If I knew how to deal with North Korea, I would be a rich lady. I mean, who knows? People have tried both. I mean, people have tried to be fairly ameliorating, to say, you know, we'll have an engagement policy, we mean well, we'll give you support, and they're criticised for being too conciliatory. And actually, those policies don't seem to have worked in the long term. Other people have gone in with much more of a big stick and said, enough is enough, we have to be serious about this, we have to crack down on North Korea, and where do you end up? North Korea, ultimately, is extremely isolated. It's a very hard state to read because it is so closed, and that the political mechanisms inside that capital are so difficult to understand. And at the moment, especially when it seems as though maybe President Kim Jong-il is going through some sort of health crisis, we hear maybe it's a stroke, maybe it's cancer, all these things are going on. Is there some sort of succession battle going on, possibly involving his sons, possibly involving the military? Who knows? And if you don't even know really who you're negotiating with, what the hierarchy is, where do you start? And that's been the problem, and the whole theory behind getting a broader framework involved to try and make North Korea play an international game.
Thanks so much, Jill McGivering from the BBC on North Korea and Secretary of State Clinton.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Lynn Scher here with Farai Chidea. We're sitting in for John Hockenberry. Police officers are taught to protect and serve, but what are they taught when it comes to race and profiling? We'll talk more about that in a minute, right after headlines with Femi Oke.
Thank you very much, Lynn. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The Justice Department now says that 30 people have been arrested in connection with a major corruption scandal in New Jersey, and the arrests include two mayors. President Obama's multi-pronged healthcare sales job hits Ohio today. He will visit the Cleveland Clinic, which the White House hails as a role model. Now, after that, he'll be on to a town hall meeting. The road trip comes in the wake of his press conference last night, and healthcare dominated the question and answer session. But he also answered a question on the racially charged arrest of Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates. The president also talked about financial regulation. The latest weekly job numbers are just out this morning. 554,000 Americans filed new unemployment claims last week. That is a jump, and it's a little bit worse than forecasters expected. Now, those are the numbers. Behind them are real people, and we talked to some of them in an earlier hour on The Takeaway. So to get that ground-level view of employment, unemployment, go to thetakeaway.org. The government really wants to jab a needle in you and maybe your child as well. Government researchers need volunteers to test an H1N1 or swine flu vaccine. They need to know if it's safe before they can roll it out in time for flu season. Earlier on this morning, we spoke to Dr. Fauci. He's the director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and he will be overseeing the vaccine trial.
This vaccine is extremely similar to the seasonal vaccines that we give routinely each year. Every fall and winter, we have the seasonal flu vaccine that's made available. It's made by the same companies, the same process, etc.
The National Institutes of Health want to adult volunteers first of all. They will test the vaccine on babies if the adult trials go well. That's a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Thanks so much, Femi. And again, President Barack Obama talked heavily about health care last night, but the very last question was about the arrest of African-American Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates, Jr. Here's what the president had to say.
What I think we know, separate and apart from this incident, is that there is a long history in this country of African Americans and Latinos being stopped by law enforcement disproportionately.
Okay, one of the questions at hand, how do law enforcement agencies train their officers to be sensitive to racial profiling? Is the training effective? Joining us, we have Dr. Philip Atiba-Goff, assistant professor of psychology at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's the executive director of research for the Consortium for Police Leadership and Equity. We've also got Rick Wager, lieutenant in charge of training at the San Jose Police Department. Welcome to both of you. Let me jump right in. Philip, what exactly is your group, the Consortium for Police Leadership and Equity?
Well, good to be here with you this morning, Farai. What we do is we create partnerships between law enforcement and world-class social scientists to do research on equity-related issues. Essentially, what happens is a police chief will come to us and say, we're concerned that we're not hiring enough women, that not enough Latinos are advancing in our ranks, or that our officers may, in fact, be engaging in racial profiling. We then get researchers with those kinds of specialties to come in and give them answers that aren't just publishable but can translate into concrete interventions.
All right. Just give us a little tiny bit of the work that you have already done with the Denver Police Department.
Well, in Denver, there was, as there have been in many large urban centers across the nation, an officer-involved shooting. The suspect was black. The officer was white. And the community asked the question, does the Denver Police Department train its officers to shoot and kill young black men? They had an interest in finding out the answer, did the chief and the executive staff. So they brought in Dr. Josh Carell to take a look at bias in the use of deadly force, and they brought in me to take a look at use of force generally. What we did then was we came in, we tested individual officers for their level of racial prejudice. We used a bunch of computer tests as well as survey right. measures. We linked then individual racial bias to use of force and right. Citizen stops.
All right. I want to turn actually to Rick Wager. You know, you're at the San Jose Police Department. And before I get to what you guys have done, I just really want to bring up that our audience is very engaged about this. We have Joe who writes, I don't buy that every police officer in the nation is racist or even that every working class white cop is racially biased. We've got also feedback from Bob who writes, I am a cop. Do you know how many people I've arrested in their own home? Too many to count. The law states if I'm dispatched to an address, then that gives me a lawful reason to be there. But once I've determined that the reason for me being there is no longer valid, then I must leave when asked. Again, Rick, you're at the San Jose Police Department. Frame for us, thank you, you know, what you guys do in terms of training around these issues.
Well, it's interesting. Since 2001, when California passed a racial and cultural diversity training law, the department has been training in this as well as all the departments in the state. And I'll just give you four quick bullet points. We train our officers to understand the cultural differences among our residents. We talk to them about the negative impacts of bias and prejudice and how stereotyping is a hindrance to effective law enforcement. And we also talk to them about that the perspectives of a diverse local community are very important. And if we don't have that respect and that two-way respect and don't develop those police-community relations, that we won't succeed in our work.
I understand that you in San Jose have reached out to Philip, again, who runs the Consortium for Police Leadership and Equity, have not worked with him, but, you know, what are you looking for to add to your you know, selection of training?
Well, I believe that my chief, Rob Davis, is looking to answer to the concerns or the perceptions of the public that our department is engaged in racially biased policing. And the command staff here has done a lot of work. We've gone to a lot of training, and we're trying to understand those concerns. And we also understand the concerns of the officers, as you pointed out a moment ago, that officers don't want to be seen as racist. And as the research of Dr. Goff and Dr. Eberhard and some of his associates points out, it can be unintentional biases that people hold that causes this racially biased policing as opposed to a bunch of racist police officers running around. And we believe that a vast majority of the men and women in law enforcement have no intention of being prejudiced.
All right. Professor Goff, Philip, There is so much antagonism that has been heavily documented between many communities of color and the police who come into the communities all the time. You know, sometimes even when there's not a racial difference between the officers and the community. How hopeful are you that we can bridge some of these gaps over the long term?
I'm tremendously hopeful. I think it's important to remember that when the laws of this nation were explicitly racist, it was the job of law enforcement in this country to enforce them. And we're not that many years away from that. During that period of time, there was absolutely no transparency to the outside world. Independent researchers could not get access to police officers and police records. And now we're in a new generation of police leadership. Chief Davis in San Jose, Chief Whitman in Denver, Chief Burbank in Salt Lake City, and the major cities' Chiefs Association have begun to open their doors to independents because they actually want progress on this issue. And so when there's, you know, where there's light, there, I think there can be solutions to this.
All right. Quickly, Rick Wager, lieutenant with the San Jose Police Department. Are you hopeful?
I'm very hopeful. I was excited when I heard that Chief Davis was bringing in Dr. Goff and his consortium to look at what we're doing here in San Jose. And I think it's going to lead to some new hiring practices, maybe some new training for our officers, and a better dialogue with the community.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us. That was Rick Wager, lieutenant in charge of training at the San Jose Police Department. He's been on the force for 18 years. Also, Dr. Philip Ativa Goff, assistant professor of psychology at the University of California, Los Angeles, also the executive director of research for the Consortium for Police Leadership in Equity.
And that's one story we're going to be following, and we're still going to be following the debate over health care. You can keep up to date by following Todd Zwillick's Twitter feed. He, of course, is our correspondent in Washington. Sign up for his feed at thetakeaway.org.
And while President Obama had his say last night, we are giving you your turn. Did you hear what you wanted from the president? Were you convinced on health care, or do you still have questions or concerns?
I think the real story is every single one of us have to sacrifice, and that means we have to pay for it. There's no free lunch. We're not going to cut the system down so that it gives terrible service to people. And if we don't want to pay for it, we have to give up our TVs or some other thing we buy in order to be a community of people who have health care.
This is Kelly from Dearborn, and I feel that President Obama is being disingenuous with a red pill, blue pill analogy. The red pill that we expected when we voted for him, which was single-payer health care. It's what he promised us. Now he's offering us a blue pill of doing nothing.
This is what you had to say. I'm Farai Chidea here with Lynn Scherr, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.